Hi, this is Dawn Shireen, and this is my podcast, Dancing with Bipolar. I just want to preface the next interview with a few things here. First one is, I will be speaking with somebody who is still active duty military within weeks of their separation date, however, still active duty. So there are questions that I would love to ask, but I'm not going to ask at this time due to the fact that I would hate to jeopardize anybody's retirement within this many days of, of receiving it after serving an honorable, above honorable, career for 20 plus years, just around 20 years. Right there. Secondly, I want to say, he does speak about some real life combat situations that he did need to deal with during his time in Iraq and possibly Afghanistan. So if this is triggering to any of you, believe me, I will be okay with you not listening to this show, and as well will Big Sarge. Neither of us would want to trigger anybody with his story, and I just want to let you know, if you are listening to it and all of a sudden you start feeling triggered, please just turn it off. If it is bad, I have some numbers for you. If you are feeling triggered in any way, shape, or form, regardless of the interview or not, the Active Military Crisis Line for Spouse, Kids, Veterans, and funny enough, it's actually the suicide hotline, is 800-273-8255, press 1. So that could be the difference for active military, spouses, veterans, anything along those lines. And also, there's a text line of 838-255, which I think is strictly for military. And as we all well know, my favorite chat line, 741-741, who I have actually used several times in the past. You're great. If you are in country listening to this and are triggered in Europe, dial 00800-1273-8255 or DNS-118. In Korea, 080-555-118 or DSN-118. Or in-country Afghanistan, 001-800-273-8255, DSN-111. Again, if in country and being triggered, suicidal thoughts, crisis, DSN 118 for Europe and Korea, and if you are in country in Afghanistan and suffering with mental health crisis, suicidal ideations, or otherwise in danger to yourself or others, DSN 111 for immediate help. Okay, now I don't know what the retributions are of calling those numbers. However, I would value your life over any kind of backlash that might come. Backlash is always becomes further backlash. Your life, once it's gone, it's not coming back. Okay, so let's choose life over pride, if that's what it is at this point in time, okay? All right, anyway, so there's some of these numbers, and I want to let you know there's a couple, I don't know how fluid it's going to be, there's a couple glitches with the recording, but whatever. This is a great interview. If you know somebody in the military or out of the military that is suffering with PTSD, CPTSD, and is having problems coming to terms with it, anonymously send them a copy of this. They don't even need to know. Just encourage them to listen to it and realize that this is coming from a 20-year service, active service army member who saw combat situations, retrievals, and other harrowing and otherwise mind-altering things, along with trying to maintain a family, keeping rank, testing out, and all the other stuff that goes along with being in the military, along with the segregation from normal society, and now looking to resume civilian life, and so grateful that he has actually gotten help for that to make it as seamless as possible. So anyway, without further ado, here's my conversation with Big Sarge.
Hello.
Hey, Dawn, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing? Doing pretty good.
That's good. So I don't know how you want me to refer to you. I was going to call you Sarge, but, you know, we're going to leave that up to you as far as, like, anonymity and all that goes. So I could just call you Jay, Sergeant Jay, you know, whatever's cool with you. So.
Okay, yeah, I'm cool with all that. It's absolutely okay. Yep, Sarge,
okay, cool.
Sergeant Jay, Sarge. Big Sarge, whatever.
Big Sarge, I like it. Okay. we're gonna go with that. I like that. Are you a first shirt by any chance?
Yes, on the Army side. It's Master Sergeant. I was a first sergeant, but yeah.
I like you even more. First shirts are always like, I was in the Air Force 100 million years ago. So it's like I have fond memories of my first shirt. Like not so much my other commanding officers, but the first shirt was like always like the cool dude that I don't know, just made the blows a little bit softer when they can, I guess. Right.
Yep.
Exactly. Okay. So, I'm going to let you just give the audience here a little bit or as much of a rundown on your career as you feel free to share right now. And then we're going to go from that into, you know, the two big topics, you know, which are suicide and, the PTSD, which is coincidental with suicide. So we're going to get into that. But let's hear your story first and why this concerns you. Why these, you know, why are you speaking up?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. And I appreciate having the opportunity to speak up and, you know, share my story, because really ultimately I'm here and alive, obviously. So I am at the point where I feel like I can share my story to help somebody else.
Good.
And if all I can do is help one person, then I'm happy with that. And so hopefully somebody can learn from my experiences and come out better for it, because I have now. So I definitely appreciate that. And that's really the why behind, you know, me speaking up now. And I'm going to start at the end of my career and then I'll go back to the beginning.
Yep.
So part of my ability to speak up now is that I'm 25 days from retirement.
Woohoo!
Yeah. So
you
definitely.
Short. Good for you.
Very short. Thank you. And very excited. I am in a much better state of mind right now than I have been in years. The last 2 years have been really, really hell for me. And part of it is because we finally dove into all of my issues and all of my challenges throughout my career. So, but I'm much better now. I'm ready to take on the next challenge and leave the service and stuff like that. So, so that's where I'm at. And really, so let's go back to the beginning. You know, 20 years ago, I joined the Army in July of 2001. So right before 9/11. So, didn't know what was about to happen. Right. Left, teaching high school English in Cocoa Beach, Florida. I was living at the beach, having a good life and for the Army. And, you know, 6 weeks into 6 weeks into basic training, 9/11 happened and the world got turned upside down. You know,
did they change your MOS at that point? Maintain what you were? No,
no.
Okay.
Just maintained what we were doing. Now the intensity changed, of the training for sure. But no, nothing else changes. We kept our same jobs. We went and did our thing. So, which mine was a Black Hawk helicopter, mechanic and crew chief. Nice. So yeah. And you know, so the world got flipped upside down, and I want to let the audience know that, for all intents and purposes, I was a pretty much normal kid growing up. I mean, I had divorced parents, but you know, many of us do. Really what I'm saying is I didn't have any extreme, mental health issues or challenges, before coming in the Army. So, more so than any other kid did. And you know, so it wasn't like I had a whole lot of stuff that was impacting me when I came in. But 'cause sometimes people do, and that's okay too. And because what happens is, you know, their experiences in the military can exasperate it. So which definitely happens. It just needs to be recognized by all parties involved. So, but I was not that case, but which is fine. And, you know, so so I come in the Army and I go to, 2001, I get to Fort Hood in 2002. Nothing too crazy, you know, really. I deploy in 2003 during the initial invasion in Iraq. Had a couple of emotional events. Didn't think too much about them at the time. Part of my job was I had to recover downed aircraft. So sometimes they were shot down and people died. And I had to deal with that. We had a guy in our unit also die in a rollover in Iraq. So that was my first memorial service that I attended. I don't want to say not a big deal, but, you know, able to just handle it, deal with it, kind of move on. But I was gone for a year. When I left, my son was 6 months old. And, so I got home. My son didn't really know who I was at the time. So those challenges, dealing with being under stress for 12 months, a couple of those aircraft recoveries, and that memorial service was challenging. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Okay. So,
yeah, please.
So my, and I'll pause for a second and kind of let the audience know that my story is one that is actually more popular than most, meaning my trauma is like, it's built upon layers. So it's not necessarily one event that just went crazy, whether it be, you know, an extreme firefight where, you know, my buddies got killed, or an IED situation. You know, it wasn't anything like that. Mine was, you know, several instances over a long period of time, and they just kept happening over and over and over again. And there's more incidences like me than there aren't, to be honest with you. So there's lots of people like me that have these experiences and really, you know, people need to be able to recognize them. And also that person needs to be able to recognize that, do they have trauma? They have been exposed to it, and it's okay. You're not going to hear of some crazy firefight, you know, IED, you know, situation. But so those happened. I get home. I had a little bit of trouble adjusting to home, but just being under stress for so long, being away from family, there was a little bit, you know, some challenges there. But kind of compartmentalized them, worked through them, no issues, continue with the career. Later that year, we had an aircraft crash at Fort Hood in 2004. I knew I think 7 or 8 people died, including a general on board, and one of the crew chiefs was one of my friends. So he died, so that was pretty tough. Now we move into, you know, 05, get ready to deploy. I participated in Hurricane Katrina relief, where we recovered a lot of people.
Geez.
Yeah.
Dude, oh my God.
Right. Like, so September, September 05, you know, boom, I go down to Hurricane Katrina relief for 2 weeks, come back and get ready to deploy. I left for Iraq in December, you know, right. So now.
No decompression, no downtime.
Exactly. That's, you nailed it. That's exactly it.
Damn.
06, we were in Baghdad, and that was during the surge. And we were flying an extreme amount, and the missions we were on were, you know, pretty stressful. We were doing a lot of insertions and air assaults with forces all over it. So I also encountered several traumatic events. Where I was medevac chase aircraft, and I had to put dead bodies on my aircraft. Had to deal with that. One of them, we did an air assault, and 2 days later, we had to go do a hero mission when we go and pick up, you know, a soldier that's died. Yeah. Come to find out, it was the guy that I had trained 2 days ago. And he had died out on the mission that we put him in on. So that was pretty traumatic. Got home in November of 06. And I knew I was moving in less than 90 days from getting home. And I knew, right. And I knew that I was not going to be deploying for 3 years because I was going to go to an instructor position. So, which is good, but what happened was I pushed it all away. I didn't talk about it. I didn't think about it. It just went, you know, and I forgot about it. Well, I didn't really forget about it, but of course I pretended.
Right.
So moving into, you know, 2000, late 2009, when I come down on assignment now from that instructor position, they said, okay, you're going to go overseas again for another year. Boom, nightmares immediately started. I didn't understand why. I was irritable. I was angry over any little thing that happened. I started, and of course, hindsight is so 2020, you know, when I look back and.
Well, right, of course. But yeah, I mean, at the time, you're not realizing these triggers. Right. Like, yeah.
So, yeah. So the nightmares, you know, and then I started to try to protect myself.
Right.
Before going overseas to try to predict the job I'm going to try to not fly anymore to, you know, but I didn't know, I didn't honestly realize I was doing that. I was just almost kind of making stuff up and to not put myself in that situation. Couldn't figure it out. And so boom, medicine, you know, here's a couple of therapy appointments and okay, you cried a little bit. Are you good to go? You can do this. You're okay. And I'm like, okay, sure. Yeah, I'm good. Okay. Let's do this. Right.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, you can't admit. I mean, in all this time, you're still climbing in rank and becoming, right. And becoming more of a leader. You're becoming a leader in your division. And as a leader, you cannot show your people any form of weakness whatsoever because you don't want to give them permission to be weak, even though you really do want them to be real and authentic, but you can't, you can't do that. That's danger, you know?
I did what I had to do. I got sent over there to Egypt for a year, found out the medicine I was on, I wasn't even supposed to be there, but whatever, they got that taken care of course, right?
Right.
You know, they found a waiver or something. So also medicated myself with alcohol that year. We were allowed to drink over there in Egypt, so I was drunk for the entire year. Not healthy at all. So I got home and went to Fort Riley, Kansas, and we're talking 2011 now, and the speed, and of course, yeah, I'm you know, a staff sergeant getting ready to get promoted to SARM first class E7. And, you know, the speed of the op tempo is still picking up. You know, we're talking about the political climate sounds like we're all coming home and we're leaving Iraq and Afghanistan at that around those times, but aviation, we definitely weren't. I went away for training in, you know, September, went to, you know, a couple different exercises and, you know, was pretty busy and then deployed again, went to Afghanistan in August 13 to May of 14. And the deployment itself wasn't too bad, except for obviously being gone, and which is always challenging. And then, but we lost another aircraft, lost a whole crew. And that was a pretty big backbreaker, you know, pretty emotional on me, you know, had friends on there. And so I get home in 14 and 14 is where we did not get a break from the time we got home from that deployment. We went right into work and we went right into work, right into our aircraft. And then that's when ISIS started going crazy. And in the fall, because we got home in May, in the fall, they said, we're going to Iraq and they're going to take our aviation unit. We hadn't even been home for like 4 months. So we had to try to turn our aircraft over. We had to turn our personnel over, get us all trained. And the speed just like went so fast. And that's when I started to spiral and go downhill. And my you know, I started to feel that I couldn't accomplish my job, and that meant that I was a failure. And since I was failing, then people could get hurt because.
All right, so hold on. So here it is. It's 2014. You've done two tours in Iraq. You've been to Afghanistan. You've been away from your family more than you've been with your family. You've had some catastrophic incidences happen among crew members that you knew well and have had to make some recons that no one would ever want to have to do. And now, what are you looking at?
So, yeah, it seems like it's just a lot. And, you know, so now we just got back from Iraq a few months ago and ISIS is kicking off. Or no, we just got back from Afghanistan, sorry, in 2014. And ISIS is kicking off in Iraq and they're wanting to send us right back to Iraq, our aviation units. And so, on the surface, it really just was kind of like a punch in our gut. It was like, oh my gosh, like, I mean, really, we've got to go back again. And so there's a lot to do to try to get everybody ready and to meet all the training requirements to get ready to go downrange again. So the stress level just got increased almost exponentially overnight. And yeah, so we're, you know, all of a sudden, and I'm in a leadership role at this point, I'm a sergeant first class and I'm in charge of, you know, 30, 35 soldiers and their families. And now we've got to get these aircraft fixed. We got to get them ready. We've got to get the soldiers ready, all this stuff. And then it starts piling on me and the stress really got to me. And I started grieving really hard for some of the past instances that we talked about earlier.
Right.
So all of that was starting to pile up and I definitely was, you know, irritable, wasn't sleeping, nightmares, mm-hmm. you know, and then the big, you know, feeling like I can't do this. So I missed a couple things at work. People were really upset at me for that. I'm a really high performer my whole career. So that was a shock to a lot of people and to myself.
Right.
So that was really hard to deal with. And it just started kind of piling on more and more. And I started just getting really even more upset, more stressed, and trying to figure out how to protect myself from all of this. And well, if I can't do this, if I fail at this, then people can get hurt and lose their life. So but I'm already failing, so I must be terrible. I'm awful. I can't do this. And I started down that rabbit hole and just started going. And then till one night at home, we were eating dinner and I got really visibly upset emotionally. And my wife sent my son away and, you know, said, what's wrong? What's wrong? And basically I admitted right then and there that I said, you all will be better off if I'm not alive. I'm not worthy. I'm not a valued member of my team at work. I can't do this. You know, I'm going to get people hurt. You know, I'm just a burden to everybody. And if I go get help, I'm just even more of a burden because now they've got to, you know, take me out of the
track.
Yeah, they got to track me, and they've got to escort me to get help, and then all this stuff. So since I know the process, I, you know, said the words, I don't want to be alive. I am a burden. I'm not valued. And of course, my wife was just, oh my gosh, like, you know, just
devastated.
Yes.
I'm sure.
Yes. Yeah. How, you know, she, you know, thinks the sun rises and sets with me. Right. And I mean, not so much, but, but when your husband, your spouse says those things, it's just like, oh my gosh. So that, right.
Well, I mean, it's devastating in so many ways, not only because of the fact that she probably had no idea that that's where your head was at.
Right.
And also at the point that she couldn't have seen it ahead of time and had tried, even though she alone could not fix this for you, but had tried to possibly make the transition home easier or this or that, or any guilt that she could put on herself that she caused part of this on you, which is not true at all.
Absolutely.
You know, that's like, right. It's such a double-edged sword right there. It's just like, oh my God. And then of course, you know, and let's just remind people, we're talking 2014, where there was actually like a demilitarization going on in the country. I don't even remember who the president was, but there was a lot of defunding going on around things like aircraft maintenance, Star Wars. Now we're going back to my day, but you know, basic maintenance of tools that were needed. There was a lot of sell-off going on. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of manufacturing going on, not within the United States, of supply chain items. So, I mean, not only on top of everything else that you have going on and then feeling as if you can't do your job, in a way you can't do your job because you're not being supplied with what you actually need in order to successfully complete your mission and do your job. So you're a little screwed there. I mean, it's like,
yeah,
you know, so, right. So, all right. So yeah, just to put it in context, so people aren't, you know, I mean, there was a lot of other underlying shit going on that was contributing to you not being able to, and very little of it had anything to actually do with you. So
yeah, that's a good point. So 2014. So really, I mean, it was during the Obama administration, and not picking on him at all. 2013 sequestration happened, where Congress and the White House couldn't agree on spending. So they had made a predetermined, like, devil of a deal, saying, if we can't agree, then we're just going to cut everything and we're only going to be able to spend this much money. So you're exactly right. I mean, that went into effect and it was hurting us tremendously. So, yeah, good points. And it is really good to put a lot of that into perspective for the listeners, because that stuff does matter, you know, for us down the line, as you know. I mean, it does impact us.
Big time. Okay, so you are going back to Iraq now for your third PDY?
Well, so they essentially do not send us. Cooler heads prevailed. They did send another unit, okay? But they had already put us through the stress and the training to be ready to deploy ahead of time. So, but when this happened at home, when I finally hit rock bottom, my wife coordinated to get me some help. And so I got some help, and what we ended up doing was they did move me to another unit that most likely wasn't going to deploy. But it provided me a little bit of stability is what we were kind of looking for. And so I went to therapy and I did get put on medicine. And something that I really want to point out to people too is, so the methodology, I guess, of the Army, you know, behavior health doctors is really, what can we do to get them back into the fight the fastest? No one has ever mentioned the word or the diagnosis PTSD until 2019 with me. Right. 2019. Wow. Yeah. Here we are talking. I hit rock bottom with suicidal thoughts in 2014.
Wow.
Because PTSD diagnosis comes with you know, immediate reactions from higher, as far as you got to go through further evaluations, and then they need to see if you are fit to fit to fight.
Right.
And
right. Even though you already have fought, otherwise you wouldn't have the PTSD, but we got to see if we can throw you back in the game again, because, you know, we don't know when the shortstop is going to pull a ligament there out go. There and we might, yeah, it's, yeah, I, yeah. Anyway, the listeners may not understand the game yes. behind.
That's a great, yeah. that's a great word. The games yeah. behind the so-called yep. healthcare. So yep. long story short, I did the therapy. I cried. I did whatever. They patted me on the back. They got me to where I was good enough to go back to work in this. So this new unit they put me in, yes, we had a little bit of stability, but as a Sergeant First Class, now I had in my platoon, I had 110 people I was in charge of. Right.
Wow.
So 27 NCOs underneath me. So
damn, dude, that's you. It's
right.
Wow.
I mean, talk about, I mean, just, I mean, it's like herding cats.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. And then herding their cats along right. with them. Yeah.
Right.
You got a whole lot of little red wagons coming behind you guys, yeah. man. So yeah, that's right. I bet you had nightmares. I bet that you did have nightmares about that yes. responsibility, because there was so much out of your control at that time. I mean, just because they said that you're not going to be deployed doesn't mean all of a sudden there's not some emergent somewhere that you guys are the only ones that can handle it. And yep. you got to go in your broken birds and your hope to God, this will make it there to there and get this mm-hmm. mission done. So, you know, we can try to get this fixed. And I mean, good yeah. God, you know, and you already have all this extra stuff that you've not really dealt with. So you're like Micah. You're just like building yes. layer on layer on layer.
That is perfectly yeah. said and described. That is exactly what's happening. I haven't addressed any of it. I've just covered it up and just moved on. So we can move through 2015, and I was in that position job. Two soldiers in the company committed suicide. One of my teammates died in a aircraft crash at Fort Hood. He had just left Fort Riley where I was, went down there. He was a Sergeant First Class. He died in a aircraft crash, father of seven. One of my soldiers, September of 15, died in a car accident. I had to escort his body home, do all the formal funeral stuff. And, you know, so all of that, and now, you know, getting in closer to the end of 2015, and I'm up for promotion, amazingly. And I get promoted to, that's when I became a first shirt, and mm-hmm. Early 2016, February, I moved back to that previous unit and became a first cert and a first sergeant in the Army, and got ready to deploy 6 months later back to Afghanistan. Yeah. Wow. And this was the only thing that the current doctor that I saw came and asked me before we deployed, hey, hadn't it been over a year since your suicidal thoughts? Like, that's literally how he asked me. And I said, wow. Yes.
And that was like the check. Yep, okay, you're good
exactly,
to go.
Exactly. That know? Is exactly what it was. He said, okay, you're good. Wow. Yep. So, yep.
Wow. And were you being, I mean, not, well, I don't know if you can answer this. I know you got, what, 24 days right. now? So you've got, like, what, three? You got yep. 3 Sundays left yep. or something like that. So I won't ask the question until, like, next time. We'll have you on, like, in October or something. Then I can okay. ask you the other questions that won't get you in trouble. Okay, so 2015, and you are now, again, now you have more responsibility as a first shirt. You are, like, the medium between the officers and the NCOs. And you're going back to Iraq.
Afghanistan again. In this case, yeah.
Afghanistan. Okay, to go guard the poppies.
Well, we actually were in the east this time, Nangarhar province, where ISIS was rearing its ugly head. And so Nangarhar province, okay. we were in Jalalabad, and the airfield really was okay. pretty much downtown. Okay.
Yeah, no, I know about that area. Okay, so yeah, you nope. weren't in the poppy fields yeah. this time around, but yeah. Okay, so So how are we going to traumatize
Yeah,
you this
so
time
you know, this one
around?
definitely the traumatic events that happened there were when I would get into routines, and things that would pull me out of the routines were definitely like triggers for me, because I wasn't in control of my environment. So if you know, something changed or switched, or I had to get on a bird and fly to somewhere else and I wasn't prepared for it, you know, mentally, that would definitely throw me into a tizzy. I would, you know, mentally, you know, obviously be thinking all kinds of bad thoughts. I'd be going down rabbit holes. This is going to be bad. This is awful. I'm going to die. You know, other people are going to die, you know. And so that happened a few times. And then a few rocket attacks came really close. And one of them, I was doing an interview with a reporter doing a story on the 1st Infantry Division, and it was in our 100th year. And we're sitting at a picnic table outside, and the rockets you can hear about 2 seconds before they hit and before the alarm goes off. And I heard it, and the first one hit probably about 100 meters from us. And you know, I threw her on the ground, I jumped on the ground. And at that point, it's just hope and pray, like, you know, because there's usually two or three more coming. So, you know, that was pretty scary. And then, of course, you know, at that point, like, look, you know, we're talking 2016, 2017, is that deployment, and everything I've already been through, it's like I'm done at this point. Like, my mind, like, that's it. I can't function
No
anymore.
more.
So, but somehow I made it through it, and went through several of those instances and challenges, and then came down on assignment again in 2017, pretty quick after we got home, and moved to Fort Bragg, and in 2017, and then some things really happened with the chain of command and the new unit. And I ended up needing to get help sooner than later. And when I got to the unit on a Friday, I got a text on a Saturday evening that said, "Hey, pack your bags. You're going to get on an aircraft. We're down in Georgia in the field for a few weeks doing gunnery, and we need you here." I'm like, "Well, I don't even know where I work. Like, who are you? Like, what is this?" Like, so yeah, that was my welcome to the unit. Yeah, packed my stuff, headed down there for 2 weeks, came back. Yeah, some couple other disasters happened. I had to organize and run a change of responsibility ceremony for the E9s, for the new sergeant major coming in. I had never done that before. I had no idea what I was doing. They were yelling at me. I'm like, "Okay, sure. I've never done this. Do you realize that?" And then so anyway, that happened. And then we had to go to the field right after Thanksgiving again for a week. Like, you know, and that whole thing was a disaster. They treated a lot of the soldiers really bad, a lot of the officers. And so I tried to protect them and get in the middle of it. And I said, "This is absolutely asinine." So I had to go to, I had some doctor's appointments after that in early December. I required shoulder surgery in 2016, but I turned it down so that I could go on that deployment to Afghanistan as a first shirt, right? It's just the responsible thing to do. It's what I'm supposed to do, right? So once I got to Fort Bragg, I said, "Hey, I need to get my, you know, shoulder looked at." And anyway, I got it looked at. "Yep, you need to get surgery done. Let's go ahead and get it taken care of." And I had a whole bunch of other things. "Let's just get it taken care of," kind of thing. And so during my convalescent leave, my 30 days off to recover from surgery, I got fired from my job because of my surgery. I couldn't go to the training center for a 30-day exercise in March, and I got reprimanded for having a surgery done before a training exercise, and I couldn't attend. Right, like
That you didn't know about.
and I said,
I love it. That's great. That's awesome. It's all on you right there. No, there's no other responsibility
Right.
for any of the officers or the doctors or
Yeah.
any of the, yeah, no. So I think that's a, in my opinion, that's a blessing in disguise, actually, but let's hear
Yeah,
if that's actually
well,
what it
okay.
was.
Actually, I am going to agree with you on that, because That is, let's just call it the nail in the coffin, the straw that broke a camel's back. That is exactly what broke me. Mm-hmm. So that broke me down enough to where I, you know, this was spring of 2018, where I went back, I went and got help. And I said, I want real help. Like, I don't want you to fucking listen to me for an hour a week for a couple weeks and give me some pills. Like, I'm, you know, severely depressed. I'm, you know, I'm overly emotional at events. I'm irritable. I have nightmares. I can't. Oh, big time.
You're hypervigilant. I mean, you're beyond hyper. Yeah. I mean, because you had to be. So that alone will kill you. Just the hypervigilance on top of all, everything else, the guilt. I mean, and let's be honest here. We're going to start talking about mental health now, but let's talk about the guilt that you felt. That why did you live when such and such died, when he had this responsibility and I only had this, and trying to marginalize the reasons why you're still here to tell your story, obviously now, but at the time, I mean, I can't even comprehend that. I honestly can't. And I'm grateful that I don't need to. But I mean, on top of that, and then the your family responsibility, that though you were getting paid and money was getting sent to them, you were not there to like emotionally support them in a way that it sounds like you're that kind of a dude that's what you're all about. You're all about emotionally supporting all the people around you and making sure everybody's okay. And that, you know, and not that you forget yourself, but I think probably at times you have, and that, you know, putting yourself second to other people, and it's just, you know, you're just like, you were in quicksand.
I absolutely was. I always put everybody first. You know, I didn't take care of myself at all. But the other people that I didn't put first was, you know, my wife in a lot of ways, my son, I did, you know, in some ways, but you know, I put the Army and everybody else first all the time.
Well, you have to. Okay. I mean, let's be straight. When you go in there, they're like, if we wanted you to have a spouse, we would have issued you one. And that still holds true, you know? And, there's that.
They're not. The guilt of being alive, as you said, it's there. It is. And so many instances of it. So the friend of mine that died in the helicopter crash in 2015 at Hood, he was a father of seven. I'm a father of one.
Right.
It doesn't make it any less or more, but I should not have ever thought about it in that manner, but I did. Like
of course you did. Because you have a conscience.
And trying to rationalize all of those things, and none of it is ever rational. It doesn't make any sense, but at the time it does. Nope. And it's, absolutely. So all of those things, you know, were weighing on me, and then trying to even discuss them and figure that out through some of these therapy sessions. The best thing that happened for me at that time in 2018, when I started to go, is I did get matched up with somebody consistently, the same therapist, which, you know, as you know, just doesn't happen a lot in the military, because they're in the military too a lot of times. And
just the turnover.
So
it's crazy. I would never want to be an officer doctor. I would never want to have been an officer, period. That's not what I'm all about. It just didn't suit me. I could have been, I was smart enough for it and all that. You are obviously too. You definitely could have be like a 2-star general by now had you gone.
Well, thank you.
I swear. I mean, you're very intelligent. So you're welcome, but you're not sellout, so to speak. So, you know, so, you know, I get that. And like when you're an NCO, and especially like when you become first shirt, and once you've always held that first shirt, you're always first shirt, regardless of how much further up you go. It's a big deal. You know, people in the military don't get it. And like, so when you say to somebody, I earned my stripes, they don't really actually understand the context of what that means, because it's the hurry up and wait, and it's the FUBAR, and it's all the other bullshit that goes along with it, that you earn your stripes by learning patience and how to be compliant and still maintain individuality. And that's where I had issues in the military, but you know, So yeah, I mean, I give you like, it blows my mind to think about it, because like people think, oh, 20 years military, no big deal. They're not thinking the minute by minute, second by second, in some cases where you're having a mortar shell blast off 100 yards from your face. I mean, like, you know, I mean, there's a lot more to it, people, than you know, collecting food stamps and hoping to God that your wife can find a job off base so that you guys can make ends meet.
And there's and there's all of that you just said. So, absolutely. Yeah. It's a lot.
Yep.
And you know,
so you're cracking, and fortunately because I don't think this would have happened for a lot of people for a lot of reasons, but in your case, you are honest with your higher ups, who are your peers at this point, even though they might have different, you know, ornamentation on. They're your peers, and they actually probably respect you more because you've done combat duty, or they've sat at a desk and listened to it and watched it on CNN. So, I mean, if they have any brains about them, they respect you way more than their pay rate, you know, because, you know, you've been there. So, you know, so we've got that. And you are fortunate enough to actually get help on base without being stigmatized to a point of being told to either just shut up, leave it alone. Here's your golden handshake. Get away from us, you know, with this story. But you're granted help.
Yeah. So there was a little bit of issue. Now, I did get isolated. I got pulled out of my job. I got pushed down the road into a barracks manager position. No.
Okay, but did you didn't lose any rank? They didn't like try
to. They allowed me essentially to go get the help I needed. And yes, but I wasn't, you know, I definitely was isolated, which probably wasn't the best thing to do, but I understand why they did it. But yes, I didn't get in trouble. Like, I didn't get reprimanded. I didn't lose rank. I didn't know. And so, yes, and I was able to get that help. Now, part of that, to be honest with you, is because of my rank, I think. Yep.
Yes, absolutely. Your experience was vital that they not lose you to some institutionalized situation where it could have gone way bad.
So, for you back. You know, so, I basically, cause I had stood up on the desk and said, I'm getting help. Like, I'm not leaving here until, you know, we got to figure this out. So, yeah. So I went down the road and I did group therapy and I did individual therapy and I, you know, started, you know, reading books, and there was a lot of ups and downs, through that process. But I was with one counselor for almost a year. And then when I got to the second one, who is my current one right now, she's the first one that said, she looked through my diagnosis and said, this is all garbage. She said, they have misdiagnosed you so many times in your medical records. She said, we need to clean this up. We need to officially diagnose you with chronic PTSD. There's nothing to be afraid of. It's what it is. And it's the right diagnosis, and the doctors and, you know, everybody needs to know it and understand it. You need to know it and understand it. And I said, that's awesome. That's the first time I've ever heard anybody say it to me. And so, you know, you pointed it out. I really was lucky to go through that, because a lot of junior soldiers don't get this opportunity and don't get this treatment.
Right. Well, they don't even know it's available to them. Plus they do not want anybody to know that they're having an issue, especially if they are the main breadwinner in a family, which is still just barely living above a poverty level. They can't, they cannot afford to lose their job. You know, I mean, as a junior soldier, I mean, they're pretty replace. I mean, I know it sounds terrible, but they're pretty replaceable. You know, I mean, it's not like somebody at a three-star rank where they've invested some time and money, and you know, they'd prefer to hang on to you than lose you. So, but you know, an E1, E2,
right?
You know, it's, it's dropping the bucket. You know, so yeah. I mean, it really is. I mean, I'm being honest, and I've been out of the military for a minute, and I I kind of probably say stuff I shouldn't sometimes about it. I love my country. Don't ever get me wrong. I will defend my country to the end. My government,
yeah,
not always so fond of my government. So, yeah, you know, yeah. So,
yeah.
And you know, anyway, we can talk about that some other time. But anyway, so, all right. So you're getting help and you are doing what?
Yes.
Like a cognitive so behavioral
we were
therapy
doing, you know, CBT, cognitive yeah. behavioral therapy. I was doing that weekly with my therapist. And then last September, so actually, let's go back to last spring, a year ago, they finally wanted to send me to an inpatient care. The doctors did. And for a couple of reasons. One was they really think that I needed that intense therapy to address all of these issues. And also, I had a problem with alcohol at the same time. Yep.
Yes. I was going to say detox. I kind of knew. Yep. Yeah. I kind of knew we still had this underlying issue.
I needed to deal with
alcohol,
both of those. Well,
yeah.
COVID hit. Yeah. Fort Bragg wouldn't let me go.
Yep.
Yeah. The inpatient place uh-huh. said I could still come. And then Fort Bragg said, nope, it's not an emergency, meaning I wasn't a threat to myself or anybody else. So they didn't deem it an emergency. So.
Right.
I continued with therapy here and, you know, doing alcohol dependency therapy plus cognitive behavior therapy. And then you know, I went sober for 5 months, which did help quite a bit. And then in the fall, last fall, I did prolonged exposure therapy, which was hell. I'm going to tell you, it Ooh. Was...
Yeah, let's hear a little bit about this because explain it to
yeah,
the audience
so,
what this is all about.
All right, so
this is
the theory is we're going to take the most traumatic event, the one that controls me the most, the one that brings me the most grief, the one that, you know, upsets me the most. And we've got to train my brain and me to really to be able to control it, not allow it to control me. So in order to do that, we met twice a week for an hour and a half each time for 6 straight weeks. And I had to tell that story.
Oh my God.
Over and over and over God. Again for that 90 minutes. Every session to get to where, I mean, and it was, I'm crying during it, you know. Yes.
So I'm yeah. ill. Yeah. Physically ill. I'm sure.
Yes.
I mean, blacking out, I'm sure. Cause it was trying a protection in your brain. I mean, folks, we're kind of talking about like the scenes in, oh my God. Where they drip the milk in the dude's eyes.
yeah.
Oh my God. It was just there. And now it's gone. Anyway, it'll come back to me. Crap. A Clockwork Orange. It's similar to that, like a deep
yeah.
programming type thing of,
so
yeah. Yeah, that's awful. That's nearly barbaric, actually. That's,
yeah, so it was,
you know,
it was, I mean, the hardest thing I've ever gone through. You know, I think I like to think that it helped. It was surely was painful, and I was exhausted at the end of the 6 weeks. I was so exhausted.
Absolutely.
And you know, like, I mean, this story, like I think it helped, but at the same time, I'm just like, I mean, it still sucks. Like, I'm still sad about it. Like, it's still awful. So, it, you know, but at the time also, I mean, look, I'm just willing to do the work, like whatever. Yes. Yes. Like make
do
this
anything.
Nightmare stop.
Right.
Like,
exactly.
Please let me
yep.
sleep through the night, yep. you know? Yes.
Right. Right. You're like to help me help myself so I can see over this, because if this is all it is, man, then maybe my first thought back when all this shit started was maybe not the worst idea, which as you all know, I do not condone suicide. We are aware of this on the show. So, but we all know that sometimes it is that flash idea that comes to our ideas, because that was a safe coping mechanism that we had at one point in time, that thought gave us relief enough
yeah.
to move past it into the next thing. That's okay. That's all I'm going to say about it. But then my audience knows my thought. I have many shows about suicide, so they know. Well, they know. And I also just lost my best friend last September 11th. He actually committed suicide on September 11th. So yeah. So so they've been through a ride with me on that, and I also am a suicide survivor. So I see the whole picture around it, and it makes it really weird for me to talk about it, because I can debate every mm-hmm. angle on it from any side, you know, because I've been through it. With Christopher's suicide, I've been through it all now. So it's like, and it's a club I so wish I never got to join.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, yeah, it's a horrible club. So, yeah. So, all right. So you're getting well, and time's mm-hmm. progressing, and you're getting shorter as time is going along here. So I've got, and you're doing well now. You're within, mm-hmm. what, 3 Sundays of being a civilian, and right. So now what? You're always going to be Army. You're always going to have that brotherhood. That's never going to stop for you. But now that you're out, when you're mm-hmm. out, you actually have more freedom to help. Right? So do you have plans, or, I mean, after you reignite yourself with society is not normal in any way, shape. Okay. But in our, whatever, in civilian society. Okay. So, What is it that you plan to do short term, long term to?
Yeah, that's a great question. And
your fellow brethren,
you know, I have put a lot of thought into this, and it's changed over time. But I have an incredible opportunity when we move in a couple months. We have a place established. It's, you know, rent free for probably about a year. So our family is really helping us make this transition as stress less as possible. And really encouraging all of us mm-hmm. to just, you know, take some time to relax, but focus on what it is that we really want to do. And helping people, and especially veterans, but even just other people, is definitely high on my list. Sharing my story and showing them that you can make it, you can overcome these stuff, but I'm not going to tell you it's easy. I don't have a quick fix for you. So I also do a podcast, but it's not totally focused. It is focused on my service. And I did talk about my PTSD a little bit, but I have a couple mm-hmm. of other shows in creative development a little bit, just kind of good news stories to help, you know, people kind of be positive out there. But I'm setting up a kind of a digital content, not mm-hmm. digital, but content space to where when I get to Atlanta, I'm going to integrate with the veterans communities and also the high risk youth, you know, communities, and try to do, you know, great. Just speaking and mentorship with as many people and groups as I possibly can. To try to bring some positive attention to these issues and to help as many people as I can. That's what I'm going to try to do. Mm-hmm.
I have a question. So the youth, our youth now are scarred for life because of this COVID triangulation mm-hmm. that they gave the kids, where, you know, they couldn't hang out with their family and they couldn't hang out with their friends. And they were isolated for that 1 year period of time, and they were severely isolated from general population. You know, we all were, but in their instances where their minds were growing, you know, where that's very, very important for them during this period of time in their lives to have that association with other people, they were stripped of it for a full year. Now, these kids are going to be recruited in, not all of them, but a majority of them are going to be recruited into the military, and they're going to be coming in having suicidal ideations already in their heads due to mm-hmm. this COVID, you know, distancing that we've been through. Do you think the military has any form of contingency in regards to that issue along the top with everything else that, you know, comes into being in the military, going through basic training, and just being young.
No, and absolutely not. It is scary.
That's scary.
It is. Listen, how we recruit is all about numbers, period. They are not prepared to, because, so here's another problem. The eligible pool in our country is shrinking by the day. And so there's only so many people that are even eligible to join and serve. So it puts so much pressure on the recruiters and the services just to meet their numbers, which.
Okay, wait, so I got a question. So we'll get back to the numbers, but why is it shrinking? What happened?
Education, mental health, like already, okay. Like known, you know, kids, young people that already have issues. Yes, all those things. So it's
anxiety,
they're already discriminating factors, and they can't. They're not even eligible.
Yeah.
So it's.
Wow, I never even thought about that. Okay, so then it's a numbers. So now we have a numbers game out of a less than.
Right. Like it's something like
24%
of 18 to 35 year olds are eligible. Right. Or even eligible. So again, whatever that number is, of course, there's only so many that are going to do it or that want to do it. So that just makes it tougher. So details of answering your question is, so they're still, our recruiters are still like, okay, if you smoked pot, just don't tell me about it and you're good. So in other words, if you have had suicidal thoughts in the past, just don't worry about it. Don't tell me and you'll be good. Like that's their attitude.
Right. And again,
mm-hmm.
And then again, these people are desperate for money, a job.
Right.
So they're like, whatever, you know, I can do 8 weeks at Bragg, or I don't know what it is for the Army, but it's something like that, you know, and get to my regular job and have a quote unquote regular life. And that depending on their MOS, of course, not understanding that not everybody works 9 to 5 in the military. And stuff comes up and you get called out and you might get special details according to your level of secrecy that you hold. And I was smart enough to remain single and not have a family, because I could only imagine the complications that would have caused for me alone, being a young female in the military back in the 80s we're talking now. But still, it had its own stressors, and there were still suicides when I was there at Ramstein. There was like a little epidemic of suicides that went through like 1 year when I was there, and still not sure what that was all about. But of course, we'll never know because we don't talk about that shit. So, exactly. So that's a scary thought, that we have unprepared military having traumatized soldiers coming in. And that kind of just seems like it could be asking for a catastrophe.
It's going to put a lot more pressure, on the leaders.
Yeah.
So. You know, the NCOs are trying to do two things. They're trying to accomplish the mission and take care of their soldiers and families. And, you know, if 90% of their time is being spent towards one or two people, you know, because of these issues, it's really challenging. And then it starts to put a lot more pressure on everybody else too. It's a domino effect.
Total domino effect. And then other people feel like they don't matter in the unit, and then they go off and start doing their own, you know, maladaptive whatever. And I watched it happen at when I was stationed at Ramstein. We had one really bad tech sergeant come in who thought he thought he knew what it went really badly. And we actually did have a suicide involved in that. I'm still not quite as sure it wasn't a sexual, which we're not even going to get into that part of the military right now. But so we did have it. We had a suicide occur around that. And we had some bad alcohol related. We just had a bunch of shit go down. So because the military is so tightly knit within your unit, maybe not as well, it's all tightly knit, but you know, there are gaps here and there. It has to be for intelligence reasons or, you know, safety, whatever. But for the most part, it's very interwoven, and this depends on that, depends on that. And if we're having a major issue over here in this department because of lack of pride in our unit, or we don't have respect to our leaders, or we have a division, a class division going on within our own unit, then we've got serious problems and no ability to fix them, because there's not enough quote unquote research to give you education on how to fix that.
That's
Is that close? Okay. So
yeah.
What do you think is the fix here? let's break it down this way. If you could give your three major points to the commander in chief, and know that it would be understood, respected, and pass forward with implementation and tools in order to
implement
it.
The first one is,
what would you ask for?
Mandatory annual behavior health screenings. We do that with physical. We do a physical every year, but we don't do that mentally. So that's my first one. Everybody should, you know, be able to go and have a screening, a conversation. And if it leads to needing more or wanting more, because again, going back to, we're scared to go get help. But if this is a mandatory action, nobody notices that, he's going to behavior health, or, you know, well, of course he is. He's got his annual exam. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, they've got to do more than what they're doing, as far as, they verbalize that getting help is a sign of strength and not weakness, but you don't see that action. And what I mean is, and I actually said this to Sergeant Major of the Army a few weeks ago, is, as I said, the second thing is, not only do you need to say that it's okay to go get help, but you need to prove it by maybe relocating that person out of that high stress job, but not firing them, but putting them in a situation where they can focus on getting help, but not feeling like they're letting the unit down. That's the second thing. Because that will encourage people to get help. And
lastly, what would be your dream to tell our commander in chief?
All right. So yeah, the three things, like, listen, number one is, let's do a mandatory annual mental health screening. We do it physically. We have an annual physical, but we don't do it with mental health. This gives the service member an opportunity to go and talk to, you know, the therapist, without somebody saying, oh, he's going to mental health or something like that. And if there needs to be more appointments or anything after that, this gives them that opening to just kind of open up and say, hey, maybe I do need some help. So that's my first thing. Second one, you know, is, so they do a good job of saying that, you know, seeking help is a sign of strength and not weakness, but their actions speak differently. So they need to show people down at the unit that, hey, if you go and get help, we may also move you to another less stressful job that's not, you're not getting fired, but provides you the opportunity to go get the help you need and focus on you and your family for a certain amount of time to see if you can get healthy and get back into the fight, instead of having that pressure of trying to get healthy while you're running at 110 miles an hour.
Exactly.
You know, so let's walk the walk when we talk the talk of saying, hey, it's okay to go get health, but then we get upset when they have appointments or we still put them in a high stress job. So that's number two. Number three is, when we talk about readiness in the force, and everybody loves to talk about down at the squad level, and this is, you know, the smallest level unit, and this is, these people right here are the ones that are going to recognize if their teammates need help. And this goes for people outside the military. Somebody's inner 3 to 5 people. Mm-hmm. We need our senior people to tell them that it's okay to recognize that your friend, family, teammate needs help and assistance, and help them get that assistance. Yeah. It can't come from the 4-star. It can't come from the president. It's got to come because those people care about you. You care about them, right? Exactly. That's, I care about my closest 3 to 5 people, their opinions.
Your buddies, man.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Those, I mean, these are not just your everyday people that you are passing on the street or like high-fiving at, you know, but no, these are, this is your core. This is your posse. This is your core group of people.
Yes. And, encourage them to reach out, reach to the one that needs help. Listen, when we are in our way down in our rabbit hole and I'm thinking about ending my life, I'm not reaching out.
Exactly. Because you're just all, you're burrowed in your hole. Yes. Waiting for the clump of dirt to hit you so you don't have to make any action. But yeah.
I'm not calling the phone number you give me. I'm not doing any of those things because I already feel like I'm a burden. So those 3 to 5 people, and we need our senior people to tell us that and give us permission to, hey, help our teammates more and to say, you need to be the ones to do it. So those are my big three.
I totally agree with all of those. I would add, I mean, three, that's three good for the active service members. I would add, you know, just as easy therapy for the kids and spouses and even parents of active duty service members who are left in a caregiving situation at home when you guys got to go and run and take care of something that you can't talk about when you come home from, therefore adding to more stress on your lives because now you feel like a bigger burden because you can't even tell what you had to go and do. And
Yeah.
And then So
that's a good one. Absolutely.
So, yeah. So, I mean, that's very, very important. Relocation and stuff like that is key. Like reintegration back into society when you do separate. You know, some people don't have a problem with it and some people have a massive problem with it. And then with any other, you know, like healthcare, the VA, and we could just go on and on and
right.
on, but we're not going to do that. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And absolutely, we could go on and on and on. So I'll tell you one thing that is new, that is helping me, that I think is going to be a good thing moving forward. It's a program called In Transition, and it's for on the behavioral health side. Only it doesn't, you don't get it through your transition program, but essentially that's what it is. It's free. So my therapist is one that told me about it. So I called and set up an appointment. And so, I have a clinically licensed therapist that calls me at our agreed upon frequency, which right now is once a month through my transition. And he's going to help me when I get to Atlanta, work with the VA and make sure I have, you know, TRICARE approved therapists and get appointments ready for me.
Yep.
To help me
That's
with
so
all.
Awesome.
Yes. So
it's all awesome. I love your story because maybe hopefully after all the people ahead of you that were groundbreaking, that got stomped on and shit all over and forgotten about, maybe you're like one of the first ones that's coming through after that groundbreaking to show that the military is changing ever so slowly, but actually, you know, it's like that ship in the Suez Canal. That thing can't turn. It's stuck, but
Right.
But there's ways to maneuver it. You just got to figure out how to do it.
Yeah.
So, there's a lot more work to be done. Don't get me wrong. Situationally, societally, universally, there is a lot more work to be done regarding suicide, trauma, and mental health in general.
Yep.
However, I'm super glad to hear your story. I mean, I'm not super glad to hear your story, but I'm super glad to hear, you know what I
yes,
mean?
Your
epiphany moment and your resilience and your future. Like, you know, when you do your TED talk, like just remember how hold the little card up that says, "Hey, Nancy with bipolar." So, you know, I can remember like, and I talked to that guy on my podcast and now he's doing a TED talk.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. I absolutely see you helping so many people in 8 Sundays in a Monday.
Well, thank you.
A Monday week.
Thank you.
So you're welcome. You're welcome. And I'm going to be, I'll keep in touch with you.
Absolutely.
Maybe in October. Yeah, October. And you'll have had a few months of freedom at that time. And
yep.
Have you back on and, right? Have you back on and see if the perception is a little changed or if it's.
Yeah, absolutely. Different. That would be great. I'd love to come back.
All right. All right. Awesome. I'd love to have you. We'll schedule that. Any updates on your podcast and whatever, hit me up. I'll put them in the show
okay.
notes for you. And yeah, big support.
Thank you
to
so
you.
Much, Dawn.
This is Big Sarge, everybody. Give him a big round of applause. Woo-hoo! And you're very welcome. You have a wonderful
All right,
rest
thanks,
of your
you
evening.
Too. Bye.
You're welcome. Bye.